February 26, 2017, Mauritius, Sadhana for Parenting in Krishna Consciousness. Okay, I hope you've all got a chance to read that. If you don't, you can finish it on your own. And we're going to be looking in this seminar about doing sadhana with our children and also having our own sadhana as parents. How do you have good sadhana when you have children? And about engaging the children in sadhana. These quotes that you just read were mostly about engaging the children in sadhana. I want to look at, we're going to be looking at really from a holistic family perspective. Right? So, I'd like us to consider what are the
risk of my falling off the stage?
So what are the benefits that we get from doing regular sadhana? Benefits for us, benefits for our children. Mercy of Krishna, okay. I'd like you to think of material benefits also, spiritual benefits, material benefits. And again, I'm going to request you, if I am speaking too fast, or if I say an English word that you don't understand, you'll tell me, yes? Everybody agree yesterday was okay? You could understand me? I'm sorry, I don't know Creole at all. And I have forgotten all of my French. I studied a long time ago. So what other benefits? Spiritual or material?
Better concentration.
Better concentration, okay. What else? Yes?
Purification.
Enthusiasm.
Peace.
Peace, all right. Happiness. Developing love and devotion for Krishna and devotees. Okay, some more benefits, material, spiritual, from doing sadhana. Eagerness for service, for more service,
regulation.
Oh, attraction for the deities. Oh, we become effective preachers. Effect of the modes will be lessened.
Becoming good examples for the children.
Okay, good examples for the children. Some more benefits? Use everything in Krishna's service. Some more?
Pleasing Srila
Prabhupada. Pleasing Srila Prabhupada, all right. Yes. Simple living and high thinking? Well, I don't know if sadhana gives you simple living, but it definitely gives you high thinking. You could do sadhana and have complicated life. Yes? You could do sadhana even in a big city like London. You wouldn't go and get a cab. Yes? It improves your human relationships. What else? Yes. Practice makes perfect. Actually, proper practice makes perfect. Practice makes permanent.
No,
practice makes permanent. Yeah. Proper practice makes perfect. Not just practice. You gotta make sure you're practicing the right thing.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Get a little, you know. Proper practice makes perfect. More humble and less angry. First of all, you said less hungry. Okay. More humble and less angry. If we do proper sadhana, do we end up with a healthy diet? We should. If we do proper sadhana. If our sadhana includes cooking and offering nice things. Again, that's if it's proper sadhana, cleanliness. I think also with our sadhana, usually we do sadhana with a group of devotees, not always, but it can have for our social interaction. Okay, free from vices. Yes, compassion. What about intellectual stimulation from studying the Shastra? Done properly, it should be fun. We talked about this yesterday, yes? That Krishna is fun. And if we're conscious or aware of Krishna, we should be having fun. Prabhupada said, if you're not joyful, then you're just a pretender. One of those very heavy statements. You read it and go, whoa. I told you someone just asked me that just within the last month. They said, how can we make Krishna consciousness fun for our children? And I said, if you are actually conscious of Krishna, it must be fun. Because Krishna's a young boy. And he's very playful. Yes? He's not some old, stodgy.
Do you believe in me? You believe in me, you get to go to heaven. Do you believe me? No, you don't. You go to hell.
It's not like that's not God. That just even Narayan isn't like that. Even Narayan isn't just sitting in a big throne with everybody just saying Gloria, Gloria. You know, he has fun. He takes the form of a pig and a half man, half lion, and a fish and a turtle. That's fun, huh? Sadhana should be fun. Right, it's nice to meditate sometime on all the benefits, because Srila Prabhupada writes in the preface of the Nectar Devotion that everything we do, everything, is motivated by what? Anybody know? For our senses? Well, okay. But he's saying everything. Material and spiritual. By the way, we don't mind children. You don't have to take the child away just because the child is making some little child noises. Please tell that devotee. These are seminars about children, and if you can't tolerate children, you don't belong here. So, please tell that Prabhu. He doesn't have to take the child. Just child was just going, and immediately he thought, I have to leave. If the child's screaming, yes, you have to leave, but just little ordinary child noises. This is seminars about children, yes? So you're all accustomed to children, yes? So Prabhupada says in the Nectar of Devotion, in the preface, yes, we like children. These are children seminars. These are seminars about children, so we like children in the children seminars. Fine. They certainly do not bother me. And if they bother any of you, you are in the wrong seminar. Hare Krishna. All right. So, Prabhupada says in the preface to the Nectar Devotion, which if you haven't read it at all, please go home and read it. If you haven't read it for a long time, please go home and read it. I find it one of the most sweet explanations of bhakti. Practically, the whole science of bhakti yoga is contained in that one essay, the preface to the Nectar Devotion. And Prabhupada says there that everything we do is motivated by rasa. Everything we do is motivated by the taste or the pleasure that we get from it. So the honest truth is, if we're not getting any pleasure from something, guess what? We stop doing it. Now, of course, there's 12 rasas. Sometimes the pleasure we get from something may be ghastliness, or anger, or fear. You all know the 12 rasas? Everybody knows? Yes? You know? Or not? So what are the 5 primary rasas? Everybody should know this. Neutrality, let's say in English, neutrality, servant, friendship, parental, and conjugal, romantic. And what are the 7 secondary rasas? Chivalry, which has 4 subparts. What else? Fear, yes, what else? Joy or comedy, anger, ghastliness, wonder, and compassion or sadness. You might say, well, how does people enjoy sadness? But they do this regularly. Somebody goes to see a sad movie, yes? They're paying money to see a sad movie. Was it a good movie? Oh, it was a great movie. I cried so much. So, we are enjoying sadness, but we are enjoying anger. That is why people go to political rallies and why people watch sporting events, so they can enjoy anger. Correct? Yes? You've seen people at sporting events? Get back here, man! You know? So everything we are doing is to enjoy one of these rasas or some combination of these rasas. And if we are not experiencing, of course, there's the spiritual rasa and then there's the material perversion of the rasa. But if we are not enjoying any of these rasas, we will stop the activity. We will not continue some activity unless there is rasa. So the main reason for our doing our sadhana has to be that we're getting some sort of pleasure from it. There's some experience. And ultimately, of course, we should be getting that rasa with Krishna. But even if it's not pure, Yankurodakama Sahaja Pranayani Diti, that's all the Moha Guru Gora Visayi Sanchin Chajasram Sadhusim Tamaratan. Even if it's not pure, better to have some emotion in sadhana than no emotion. Bhakti is about emotion and desire. In the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, just think of me with love. And if you can't do that, do sadhana bhakti. And the Sanskrit he uses there, this is Bhagavad Gita 12.9, is abhyas yoga. Abhyas literally means to repeat, like we're talking about practice. When we say we are practicing something, we mean we are repeating it, correct? You are repeating it over and over. So abhyas yoga is repeating yoga. Now, that may seem a little peculiar, because our yoga, bhakti is about love and devotion. So nice, many of you talked about love and devotion. How do you practice love? That may seem very strange. How do you practice love? But the way that we practice love is we do the same things in practice that the perfect devotees do spontaneously. And because that love is already within us, it's not coming from some other place, that practice awakens it. Prabhupada says very clearly that we're not practicing to do something artificial. It's not like we're practicing ballet dancing. It's more like we're practicing walking. And the infant, the newborn infant, has a natural ability to walk. It doesn't have a natural ability to do ballet dancing. So by practicing walking, that natural ability comes out. And what is Krishna saying in 12.9 is the purpose of Abhyas Yoga? He says the purpose is Icha. Icha means desire. So the purpose of our practice yoga, our practicing love, our practicing devotion, is that our desire for Krishna gets more and more and more. And Rupa Goswami, in giving the qualifications for taking up practice bhakti, practice love, this is the International Society for Practicing Love. What is the qualification? Rupa Goswami says you have to have some taste. Taste again means rasa. You have to have some sense of, oh, I like Krishna. I want to fall in love with Krishna. I want to come to the point of serving Krishna. So for doing our own sadhana, this is the most important factor. And if we lose sight of this, then we're not really doing bhakti. So the definition of bhakti, I'm sure again many of you know, is anya vilasita sunyam jnana karma anavitam anukulena krishnanu shiridam bhakti. So the shivana means action. And action means both action externally, moving my hand, and it also means action of the mind and the heart. It means also internal action. If we're just doing action of the physical body, it will work, but it will take a very, very long time. And then that's not really bhakti. Then you go to Bhagavad Gita 12:10, where Krishna says, if you can't do Abhyas Yoga, then do Krishna Karmani. Then work for me. So if we are doing just the mechanics of sadhana, without any rasa, without any taste, without any pleasure, we're not doing it with our mind and our heart, then we're not really doing sadhana. We're actually just working for Krishna, which eventually will also make us perfect. I'm going to move a little bit more into the fan. Oh, look at this beautiful garden. Of course, the modern roses, they look pretty, they have no fragrance. When I was in Melbourne, the devotees were quoting that Prabhupada said, this is a well-dressed gentleman with no qualifications. One of our senior devotees characterized himself. He said, I am like this scentless flower offense. I look good, but I have this no... Alright, so that's the basic principle of our sadhana. And if we're finding, and that this principle of finding some rasa in our sadhana is the main thing that's going to keep us going, really looking at these, we may be getting rasa even from the material side of our sadhana. My dear friends, some rasa is required. Okay? Don't worry. Please don't worry. Oh, I'm doing my sadhana also for this reason or that reason materially. Ultimately, that is not good, but some kind of rasa should be there. And this is the example that much better to have some kind of taste, some kind of desire, than to be flat. Krishna is much happier if we're approaching him with some emotion. So even if it's material, some kind of desire. Otherwise, as I say, it's not really bhakti. So this we must cultivate. And if we're having difficulty with that, we'll actually be discussing tomorrow night. Tomorrow night is not about parenting in particular. It's the splendid instructions to the mind by Raghunath Das Goswami. And I'm not sure when we're starting. We keep changing the time. 6:30, 7:00.
6 o'clock.
Come at 6. And hopefully we will start at 6. So then we will be looking at what are the cures for if we're doing bhakti externally, but internally, and that's one of the many things we will look at there, but internally we don't have this peace and joy. Oh, just comfort. If you don't care about the splendid instructions to the mind. But I think we should only give prasad to those who come to the seminar.
They will get.
They will get. You know, like in the Tirumala temple, up on the top of the hill in Tirupati, after you see the deity, of course, seeing the deity there is a big thing. You have to get in the queue. How many of you have been there up at the mountain? Oh, not very many. Hare Krishna. So people climb the mountain. I've never climbed the mountain. I'm not so dedicated. So they're climbing the mountain. It can take them, you know, 4 to 6 hours to climb the mountain. And they have... There's also stairs. So it's very nice. The authorities there, they've created a covered walkway and stairs, and periodically there's water to drink and toilet facilities, and they are piping in devotional music as you're walking up the mountain. So many people walk up the mountain, and then when you get there, you get in the queue. And if you don't pay any money, then you get in the queue. It's like 6 to 12 hours in the queue. They have benches and things like that. And if you pay a little bit of money, you get in the faster queue. And if you pay a lot of money, you get in the much faster queue. I mean, a lot of money means like 300 Indian rupees. And then after you're in the queue, and everybody's pushing. Like really pushing. You're not sure if you're still going to have any lungs when you are finished with this. And then everybody's saying, "Go, Linda!" I give that every 5 seconds. "Go, Linda! Go, Linda! Go, Linda!" You're not sure if you're going to be able to say "Go, Linda," because you're going to be, "Go, Linda!" And finally you get up to the deity and you get to see him for 2 seconds. You get up there, really, I mean, maybe if you have some connections, you can see him for 30 seconds, maybe. It's possible. They have such eagerness. Why was I talking about that? About getting in line to see the deity. Ah, the prasada, thank you. So after you go through all of that, and you see the deity, then you get a little ticket that proves that you went through all the tapasya to see the deity, and then you can use that ticket and you get a free meal. If you don't have the ticket, you have to pay. So I thought that was very intelligent. So if people don't come to the seminar, then they have to pay. And if they come, you give them a ticket and they get for free. But don't worry, we won't make you stand in the queue for 12 hours. Anyway, so we'll be discussing there many things, but we'll also be discussing this problem where there's a disparity, a difference between our behavior and our mentality. So having looked at that, I now want to look just at some kind of external, technical, practical considerations. So when my husband and I first opened a Gurukula in Detroit, Michigan. That was in 1982. So keeping in mind these instructions from Srila Prabhupada that you just read, we didn't have an ashram school. I think we had the first day school in this country. But that we required that the children go to the temple for Mangal Arati. That was our requirement. Then some years later, we opened a school in North Carolina in America. And when we met with the community, many of the parents said, we don't want to go to the temple for Mangal Arati. We want to have our program in our own home. And I remember thinking at the time that that was a compromise, that that wasn't as good, that a program at home was not as good. But everybody wanted it, so we agreed. And over the years that we were there, I came to see that there were benefits from taking your children to the temple, and there were benefits from having a program at home. And I came to understand that if we only brought our children to a temple, then it was like we were training them that you could only do sadhana at a temple. And the difficulty with that is most of the children will get married and have jobs and so forth. And then they will think, well, if I can't go to a temple, I can't do any sadhana. And we see many people, they become grihasthas, and their sadhana goes down. Because without the support of going to a temple, they don't have time. The temple program starts at 4:30. It doesn't end until 9, with breakfast 9:30. And who can do that? Who can do that with a job going to school? I mean, I was at one temple where the program ended at 7:30. They were really facilitated people in the world. But most of our temples end very late. It's a very long program. What to speak of, you know, Prabhupada instituted the ISKCON sandwich, where we also have an evening program. And we see that most householders, if you're actually a householder and you have a house, and you have a job or a business, and your children are getting an education, then doing this is extremely difficult. And so people end up doing either nothing or just their 16 rounds. And often 16 rounds here and there and up and down and back and forth. Yes, am I correct? So I saw something very interesting, that when the children had sometimes a program at home, and sometimes the program at the temple, it gave them a much more firm foundation for their whole life. That they can understand, I can be part of the temple program, maybe on the weekends or on holidays when there's time, and then I can also, on my regular days, have some sadhana at home. And we required for the school children Mangal Arati, Bhagavatam class, and Japa, those three things. And we required at least 15, 20 minutes of each. That's 1 hour. Actually, a little less than 1 hour of sadhana every morning. And I'm sure you could even do a little less. And I already told you, children are okay. You don't need to be stressed. I actually really mean that. I'm not just saying that. I genuinely mean that. Okay? I'm a mother and a grandmother, and I had my children in the classes, and I understand. So just, it's all right. As long as she's not screaming, it's okay. So I saw that the benefits of the temple, we really felt the society, you got to have the social interaction, got to have a variety of speakers and work enthusiasm in the kirtan, very regulated deity worship, and so forth. But at home, the children got to participate more. You know, in some temples, the children get to participate a lot in the morning program, but I think that that's, again, not so common. When you're home, your child can lead the kirtan. Even your children, when they're a little older, can give a class. And you can make it more child-friendly. You can arrange your sadhana so that it works for your particular child and your particular schedule. And I mentioned this yesterday, but I want to say it again, that if it's impossible to do your sadhana, a regular sadhana program in the morning, then do it in the evening. And Prabhupada would talk about morning and evening, and some places he would talk about morning or evening. So if the mornings are too rushed, if your children have to be out the door for school at 6:30 in the morning, you know, and you just want to have that time for as much japa as you can, or if you're cooking all that time in the morning. I just recently in Australia stayed at the home of one devotee, and the mother was cooking. She was cooking from, you know, she did her worship of her deities, she woke up her deities, bathed her deities, and then she was cooking until her husband went to work and child went to school. And there was no time after they left, then she sat down with her japa beads. There wasn't time to do something with the family. So, of course, one way to have more time in the morning, you're not going to like this, is to go to bed earlier in the evening. Yes. And one way to go to bed earlier in the evening is, you're not going to like this either, is to cut out the entertainment in the evening. Yes, no one's going to like that. That Anila is a fanatic. But if you should have seen me 30 years ago, then you really see what is a fanatic. But if you want to have a good morning program, you need to go to bed early in the evening. In many of our temples, we have late night programs, especially among the grihasthas. And I must admit, I find this very difficult to understand. I do understand people are going to work and they don't want to start the program, or people are out from work, but they're not starting the program until 7, 7:30, 8 o'clock. One part of the world, really, seriously, they start programs at 9 o'clock at night. And then people are eating prasadam at the program at 11 o'clock at night. And how is anybody going to wake up early and have morning sadhana? Especially if they have to drive back to their home, and some places, you know, they're taking prasadam at 11 and then people are driving an hour back to their home, and it's just, wow. What's really nice, and this is a little hint, is if we have an evening program to serve prasadam first and have that be the dinner. Then you couldn't give tickets, though, so that's the problem. But if you serve prasadam first, then people don't have to have dinner at their home. You know, you have prasadam like at 6 o'clock, and then you have a program, and you can end the program at 7:30 or 8 o'clock, and then people can go to bed, and they can get up. So in your own home, good sadhana starts the night before. It starts with what you're eating the night before. It starts with what you're watching, what you're doing the night before. So it just depends, you know, how much do we want to do this? So that is, you can't just look at the sadhana in isolation. One needs to look at one's whole life. Or I think I mentioned yesterday that one woman told me, you know, I wake up at 5:30 and it's go until 8:30 at night. So you might want to examine, what am I doing in my life? You know, we talked a little bit yesterday about value, yes? And all the things we do in this world that we think are so important that nobody is even going to remember and nobody cares about at all. So if there's things we're doing instead of sadhana, you can make an experiment. Find someone who really loves you and says, I would like to talk to you for 2 hours and tell you all the important things I did yesterday. And see if they care. So, you know, all these things we're putting in front of Krishna and all these things we're doing instead of our time with Krishna, we really need to consider, you know, what's important? Will I even care? If the people who love me the most and are closest to me, if they don't care, and ultimately I don't even care, nobody cares at all. So why not take the priority time and be with Krishna? And the interesting thing is, when we prioritize our time with Krishna, everything else works out somehow or another. And some things we don't get done, you know, it's okay. When we die, some things are not going to be done. Yes? Okay, yes? When we die, some of the things we wanted to do will not get done. So a lot of having sadhana time is prioritizing, and a lot of this is prioritizing for our children also. What message are we giving to our children? Just study, study, work hard, study, study, work hard, study, study, work hard, study, study, work hard. What about our relationship with Krishna? We're going to talk about this a little bit more when we talk about parenting according to the Bhagavad Gita. So for the temple, the best thing when you have sadhana at the temple is to work with the temple authorities to make the situation child-friendly. This may mean talking to the people who give Bhagavatam classes, that the classes are interesting for the children. I know there's a lot of temples that have a family day. Like every Saturday is a family day. Or maybe one Saturday a month is a family day. And then they particularly have classes that are interesting for the children and the families. And it's a different atmosphere. So that's something you might want to consider. If you have some place where parents with young children can hear a class on speakers and things like this to make the atmosphere child-friendly. And speaking to people on the board, the importance of including the children in the temple programs. That if we want the children to stay, we have to make them feel welcome. Right? So if you're coming to the temple and you're always told, get out, 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 then one day you're 18 and you say, okay, goodbye. So, you know, we were talking about the positive emotional experiences. How do the children feel when they come to the temple? Do they feel welcome? And one of the most important things we can do is whenever children are at the temple, we can at least make them feel welcome. Okay, you see children at the temple, smile at them, right? Some way where you make them feel that they're welcome here. And I've been in temples with my own children on both ends. I've been in temples where people are yeah, I felt like I was a criminal for bringing my child to the temple. Seriously, I mean, really seriously. I remember one time. Sometimes I think when I tell these stories, no one is going to believe that these are real stories. But anyway, at one temple during japa, so I wasn't allowed to chant japa in the temple room with my child. And they were, most of the other ladies were chanting. They didn't want me there with my child. So then I was just chanting in a corridor. And then one of the brahmacharis comes out and he says, I'm trying to sleep. And I'm thinking, this is japa time. It's not my problem, I didn't say, but I was thinking it's not my problem if you want to sleep in japa time. I said, why don't you go home to chant your japa? Okay, thanks. So, you know, you have that at one extreme, and then you have the other extreme, where you have temple leaders and the temple devotees that encourage children to offer Tulsi Artik and to make Giwiks and to help with the garlands and to lead kirtans and do various service, and they really welcome them. They talk to the children, they address the Bhagavatam classes to include the children. You hear some people in Bhagavatam class say, and all of us have taken a sinful birth in this Kali Yuga. And I'm thinking, what about these kids here? So to keep in mind that the children are listening and like that. And then again, at home, make your sadhana at home, not a copy-paste of a temple. Don't just try to take the monastic temple template and impose it on the home. But create a sadhana program that fits with your personalities, with your life, with the ages of your children, and so forth. The time of day, the particular activity, what do you read from? Are you just going to read from the Bhagavatam in order? Are you going to read from Krishna book? You understand? Make it something that works for you. I remember speaking to one woman who said, oh, you know, I just don't read Prabhupada's books. I said, why not? She said, well, I was told I have to begin with Bhagavad Gita, and then Bhagavatam, and then Chaitanya Charitamrita, but I don't like Bhagavad Gita. She said, so I just never read anything. And I said, are there any of Prabhupada's books that you like? She said, I love the Nectar of Devotion. I said, just read that. She said, oh, but I'm not supposed to. I said, then you're reading nothing. People are very interesting. So you find something that's going to be enlivening for you, for your children, according to their ages. I think I mentioned that Aruda Devi Dasi has recently published a book on studying Bhagavatam with children. So you can maybe get a copy of that and do some activities with the Bhagavatam, with your children. And as I mentioned, we have our free downloads, and those of you who've given me flash drives or hard drives, we have our festival books, which have a lot of activities from the Shastra. So have it something that is really engaging, and something where your children and your family are all involved. Another thing you can do for sadhana at home is you can every once in a while get together with other families. And I know we found this very helpful in the Grahastha Ashram, that maybe once a week you have some families gather at home. What's nice about that is you're motivated to get up because other people are coming. Yes? It's just like even if you're not very clean when guests are coming, you can. Hopefully. But anyway, so if you know that you have other families coming at 5 o'clock, then you will also get up. And then we also have some variety, so that's another option. So my own suggestion now, and I would not have made this suggestion 40 years ago, but my own suggestion now is you have some mix of having a program at home and having a program at the temple. And when you have a program at home, your most important things are, of course, to do some kind of worship, even if it's very simple, a stick of incense, a lamp, a flower, some food, some water. The basic items of worship, if you have some time for japa, and you have some time for study of the Shastra.
What's the name of the author that has it for the children?
Arudha. A-R-U-D-D-H-A. Arudha Devi Dasi. It is published by Torchlight. They've just come out with the first volume, which is for a portion of the first canto, and the aim is eventually to have a book for, you know, that will cover all 12 cantos. But it has how to study the Bhagavatam with children and activities that you can do. And as I say, we also have in our festival books. Okay, so the next thing that I want to look at is that we've mentioned this a little bit already, that our sadhana is not done in isolation of our life. It's not that you can say, I'm just going to work on my sadhana. It's a question of working on your life. And you have a paper that says worksheet. Yes? Everyone see that paper that says worksheet? And you notice it has six areas on it. So we're going to speak about each of these six areas. And what we have found is that if you want to have good sadhana, whether it's at home with a group of grihasthas or going to the temple, having these areas functioning well in your life will make a very big difference. So we're going to discuss each of these, and then we're going to take about 10 minutes where you're going to do a self-evaluation and then a little plan for improvement. So getting practical help. This means with our life in general. In traditional societies, there were extended families. People worked in a village. And I know many of you live in this area of the temple, but I wonder how many of you really help each other? Or is everybody just in their own house? You know, modern society is everyone is in their own house and you pass each other on the road. A real village, it was interesting. My sister married into a Yemenite family. She went to Israel to study, and she met a Yemenite there. He was the oldest of 10 children. And when she married him, she married into this whole extended family. And it was quite interesting to see how the family supported each other. So her mother-in-law and father-in-law, they had a little house, and of their 10 children, about probably 6 of them, when they grew up and got married, ended up living in the area. And the children could just go from one auntie, uncle house to another. And then they had many friends in the community, and they could just go to the different friends. And in a society where people help each other, you don't have the whole burden on the nuclear family. You know, one of the benefits in the early days of ISKCON, when we all lived in temple ashrams, which is a very unnatural way to live, by the way, but when we did that, the benefit was we sort of created an extended family. You know, so when my daughter was 1 month old, we were living in a temple right in the middle of New York City, so I could put her down for a nap and just ask the lady across the hallway, can you listen for my daughter? If she wakes up, take care of her. I could go down the stairs, walk out the door, and distribute books in the middle of New York City. Be distributing books for an hour and come back up, and almost every time my daughter was still sleeping. And just this other lady was just taking, you understand? It was very easy. I didn't have to hire a babysitter. Everything was just right there. And we can help each other easily with childcare, with cooking, and so forth and so on. So in our modern society, we tend to have abandoned this aspect, where we're very isolated. And I firmly believe that one thing that sparked the whole feminist and women's liberation movement was that women became very isolated and had to do the whole burden of all the cooking and all the cleaning and all the childcare and all of the laundry. And they never had any time to develop their own interests. Formerly, when there was an expanded family, the women also engaged in their own interests. Actually, Prabhupada says the ideal family, like if the husband is making cloth, the woman is also making cloth. The husband is making pots, the woman is also making pots. It wasn't that the women were just domestic workers. Anybody thinks that varnashram means women are only domestic servants is a very peculiar idea. Does anyone think Draupadi was just a domestic servant? And I really believe that this isolation of the family was one of the main reasons the women said, we're just not going to do this anymore. We have no way to develop our personality. We have no way to develop our interests. And then, unfortunately, the women responded by going out to work. It's an unfortunate part of modern society. But getting practical help makes it so we can even do sadhana. You know, if I've got to spend all of my time just taking care of the house, The house becomes our master rather than our servant, isn't it? You know, spending all of your time serving the house. And so this may require having some more community, having an international society for Krishna consciousness. Not just that we come together to worship the deity, but we're also coming together to help each other out and really forming a community in this way. I don't see too many places in this time where we do this. But the places that we do, the devotees have much better facility for sadhana. So then spiritual nourishment. I talked about this a little bit already with the idea that there should be some rasa, there should be some taste, there should be some emotion and enjoyment in our sadhana. But this is, are we doing things that spiritually nourish us? Srila Prabhupada writes in the Nectar Devotion that each of us should engage in the angas of bhakti according to our personal taste. So each of us have certain aspects of bhakti that we particularly like, isn't it? One devotee, I don't know this devotee very well, but one devotee posted on social media, it was really interesting. He had drawn a picture of like a ruler, and on one end he put, don't like very much, on the other end he put, like a lot, and in the middle he put neutral, and then he put different activities of bhakti on this ruler. That was, like, he put, don't like very much reading kirtan, like very much singing in the kirtan. So I thought that was interesting. So it's like that for all of us. Am I correct? Certain things of bhakti we're like, yes! And other things like, I have to do that. And other things it's just like, okay. And this is different for each of us. You know, like some devotees love to visit holy places with 4,000 people. I don't know if you saw, there was a video made for National Geographic of Radhana Swami's group where they take, what was it, like 5 to 8,000 people, and how these brahmacharis who are all IT engineers. If you haven't seen this video, do yourself a favor. It is really inspiring. But these brahmacharis are all engineers, and they have created this mobile kitchen. They test recipes all year, which then they increase to scale. You really got to see this video. It's just amazing. As we would say in America, it will knock your socks off. Though I think none of you wear any socks to be knocked off. So they bring this whole kitchen from Mumbai to Vrindavan. And they're feeding these thousands of people, and they take them on all these buses. And some devotees love this. You know, they save all year and they plan all year. And you know what? I don't like it at all. I went on one yatra with a few hundred people, and I said, never again. I like going to holy places with like 3 or 4 good friends. And we just sit there and have a bhajan. Yeah. So well, there's different, you understand? The thing that just somebody is like, yes, someone else is like, So you have to do what spiritually nourishes you. I love studying Srila Prabhupada's books. You can probably tell that, right? Is that kind of obvious? So I love reading Prabhupada's books. I love discussing Prabhupada's books. But I've met devotees who don't. And just recently, I met one temple president who told me, I don't like the books. I just like listening to the lectures. And it's okay. We're allowed to be individuals. So my point is, do what nourishes you in bhakti. Preferably daily. Some of your sadhana should include what you personally find nourishing. It's very, very, very important. If you can't do it daily, at least weekly. If you can't do it weekly, at least monthly. I know one devotee who's a very big businessman, very busy man. 3 days every month he takes a vacation, no computer, no phone, and just engages in intense study of chanting. Not all of us can take 3 days out of our life every month. but the concept is there. Preferably every day, even if it's only 5 minutes or 10 minutes, something that you really find nourishing, that you look forward to, that just fills you with delight in Krishna consciousness, even if it's only 5 minutes, whatever it may be. And you may also have to be creative, just like I'm giving some of you copies of Prabhupada's books as audiobooks. You know, I really like not only reading the books, I really like hearing the books. Or one devotee I know is writing children's books as a form of her own meditation. She's not so much writing the children's books for the children. She's writing the children's books because then she will meditate on the pastimes. For some people, it's maybe painting. For other people, maybe it's bhajan. Prabhupada would say whenever he had time, he would sit and have a bhajan. So maybe it's sitting down with the harmonium, having a bhajan. Maybe it's writing your own poetry. Maybe it's growing flowers. You know, whatever really connects you. Maybe it's studying philosophy. Maybe it's studying lila. Find what it is that just makes you feel alive in Krishna consciousness. And give that to yourself every day. If you're a mother with an infant, ask your husband or an older child or somebody, watch the baby for 5-10 minutes a day and let me do something that is really spiritually nourishing for me. Give yourself that time. Prabhupada said the highest principle is to save others, and higher than that is to save yourself. If any of you ever have been on an airplane, I assume most of you have been on an airplane since you live on this little island. Maybe some of you have not. But on airplanes, they tell you that if you lose cabin pressure, an oxygen mask comes down, and they say, put on your own mask first, and then help somebody else. So if I've run out of air, I cannot help you. Okay? So the next thing we have is association of fans. We don't mean this kind of fan. Although in this country, I think these are very helpful, but I don't think we mean that. We mean like in the sports games, there's cheerleaders. Yes? And you have sports in Mauritius, I assume? You have some sports teams? And do they have cheerleaders? The people that go, go team, go! Go team, go! Yes? Okay, so we all need at least one cheerleader in our life. This doesn't mean somebody who even understands what we're doing. They don't have to be a parent themselves, but someone who appreciates what we're doing. We should have at least one person in our life who says to us every once in a while, oh, I'm so glad you're bringing your child to the temple. It's so nice that you're raising children in Krishna consciousness. Someone who just encourages us. Now, it's very nice, although I must say it doesn't always happen, if the husband and wife can be fans for each other. That's a little hint. Anyway, it doesn't always happen, and you can't force your spouse to be your fan. Your spouse, in fact, that might be your biggest critic instead of your biggest fan. But it's nice if you can have that in your family, or maybe your mother, or your mother-in-law, or your sister, or sister-in-law, or a friend, or somebody. And if you don't have another just person walking around who's like that, then I would suggest you get some quotes from Srila Prabhupada and the Acharyas, and put one up on your wall. You know, find like 10 quotes. There's an article right now on Dandavats on the internet with quotes from Prabhupada. It's, the name of the article is Prabhupada Loves Children. And if you click on it, it links to another page. Prabhupada's just statements about how much he loved children and how much he appreciated children. And, you know, maybe you could write them down or print them out and every month put up a different one. And once a day, read it. You know, because everything in this world is difficult, and I think especially taking children, taking care of children, there's a lot of yajna involved. Correct? Am I correct? Yes? Is there a lot of sacrifice involved? Come on, you're not that tired. It's only 11:30 in the morning. Is there a lot of sacrifice involved? Yes. Of course, Krishna says, Sarvagatam Brahma, Nitya Yajna Pratishtitam, the all-pervading transcendence is always to be found in acts of sacrifice. But something where you can get regular encouragement. Something where you can get regular encouragement. Then association of someone who will correct us. Now, ideally, this person would be the guru, but that may not be practically what's happening. So this is somebody who knows us very well and who we trust. Someone that we are willing to take correction from without putting up our defenses and our false ego. Someone who can say, you're doing something wrong. And we just say, thank you. We need at least one person like that in our life. At least one. Somebody who can correct us. That means somebody we trust. I like to think of it as somebody who knows my good qualities but doesn't think I'm a saint, and they know my bad qualities but they don't think I'm a demon. Somebody who sees us holistically, someone who sees us as a complete person who has some sincerity and bhakti and some flaws, who's not judging us and condemning us for our flaws or artificially praising us for our sincerity. Somebody with whom we have a very authentic relationship and we trust that that person cares about us. Now, in some cases, that will be a spouse. In many cases, I'd say it is not a spouse. It may be another family member. It may be a parent. It may be a grown child. It may be an adult child. It may be a daughter-in-law or a son-in-law. It may be an uncle or an auntie. It may be another person in the community. But we need at least one person like that. Yesterday, I had somebody contact me about some big crisis in their life and how they were falling apart, etc. And I was able to say to this person, hey, you need to do this, and you need to do this, and you need to do this. And afterwards, I thought, wow, the person actually listened to me. They didn't put up armor. They didn't make excuses. They didn't put up defenses. They were open to my correction. So at least one person would. Then I say association of those with whom we can talk shop. So that's an American expression. I'm not sure if you understand this. But this means people who have a similar service to ours. So the people who are our yay, yay cheerleading fans, they may not be other parents. And the people who correct us, they may not be other parents. But we also need association with other parents. And this doesn't even have to be other people in the Hare Krishna movement. But people who have some knowledge of what we're going through. Somebody that we can say, you know, my child still isn't sleeping through the night. Oh, that's okay. It's normal. You understand? Someone we can discuss the technical details of our service. And they have some understanding. And we can share practical advice. And I see in our Hare Krishna movement, we don't do this nearly enough. Not nearly enough. I mean, what would be lovely in your community is once a month, or once every 2 months, or once every 3 months, you just simply had a sangha of parents, and you could just talk about, you know, I'm having this thing, what do you think? You know, and share ideas. I was in a devotee community, actually this happened to me several times, where there was more than one school, and the leaders of the schools never talked to each other. And so I brought them together, let's have a meeting. And then one of them said, oh, we have this problem. And the other said, oh yeah, we had that problem, and that's how we dealt with it. But we have this problem. Oh, this is how we dealt with it. And everybody left saying, that was so helpful. I said, why do you never do it? Why do you wait? I have to fly into your community before you do this. You know, just sit down together and talk about things and share things. I don't know what it is that we don't network with each other. So I would really suggest that you create some sangha like that of parents and share ideas and share. It doesn't have to be that I fly in here. You know, I was thinking some of you have told me that you've been a teacher for 42, one of you told me you've been a teacher for 42 years. You have a wealth of experience and a wealth of knowledge here in your own community. You understand? It doesn't have to be Urmila, Dr. Edith Best. It doesn't have to be me. Yes? Like Prabhu was telling me, he goes all over the world teaching cooking, and here hardly anybody asks him how to cook. Okay? This is typical. But you probably have a wealth of people in your community, and ask different people to give a seminar and or give some workshop and share things in your community. All right, the last one is understanding of the ups and downs of life in a material body. And this is extremely important, because if we think that while we are greatly infected by the modes of passion and ignorance, that we are going to get consistent happiness from our sadhana, we will be very disappointed. Srila Prabhupada says, until the stage of nishtha, it will be mostly a hard struggle with determination. Nishtha means at least 50% in the mode of goodness. People always ask, how can I become steady? And the answer is, you have to come to 50% in the mode of goodness. Then you'll automatically become steady, and you simply cannot become steady before then. It's just not possible. Once one comes to at least half in the mode of goodness, then things get much easier, and a little after that they get very easy, and things happen automatically. So we should understand that until we reach that point, we are going to have some effect of passion and ignorance, which are going to cause some ups and downs for us. And we want to be able to do our sadhana steadily through the ups and downs. So if you get out this paper that says ups and downs of life in a material body, I'm going to read a little bit from the verse and the purport, and then I'm going to read something else. So just, this is Bhagavad Gita 14:22-25. I'm not going to read the whole verse, or the whole, this is a section of the purport, it's not the whole purport. And I'm just going to read a section of the section. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, O son of Pandu, he who does not hate illumination, attachment, and delusion when they are present, or long for them when they disappear, who is unwavering and undisturbed through all these reactions of the material qualities, remaining neutral and transcendental, knowing that the modes alone are active. I'm going to read that again. He who does not hate illumination, attachment, and delusion when they are present, or long for them when they disappear, knowing that the modes alone are active. Okay, let's look at the purport, and I'm going to jump a little bit. When a living entity stays, I'm not reading from the beginning, when a living entity stays in this material world, embodied by the material body, it is to be understood that he is under the control of one of the three modes of material nature. When he is actually out of the body, then he is out of the clutches of the material modes of nature. But as long as he is not out of the material body, he should be neutral. In other words, the material body and the material mind are going to be affected by the modes, and we remain neutral. So I'm going to read a section here. This is from a well-known Christian author, C.S. Lewis. This is from his book, Screwtape Letters. I slightly adapted it. If you're familiar with the book, you'll understand how and why I adapted it. I'm not going to get into that right now. But I'll simply read this. Has no one ever told you about the law of undulation? As spirits, humans belong to the eternal world, but their bodies and minds inhabit time. This means that while their spirit can be directed to an eternal object, their bodies, passions, and imaginations are in continual change, for to be in time means to change. Their nearest approach to constancy, therefore, is undulation, the repeated return to a level from which they repeatedly fall back, a series of troughs and peaks. You can see this undulation in every department of life. Interest in work, affection for friends, physical appetites all go up and down. As long as one lives on earth, periods of emotional and bodily richness and liveliness will alternate with periods of numbness and poverty. One must ask what use God wants to make of the dryness and dullness phase. In God's efforts to get permanent possession of a soul, he relies on the troughs even more than on the peaks. Some of his special favorites have gone through longer and deeper troughs than anyone else. The reason is this: the obedience which God demands is not the absorption of its will into his, but quite a different thing. He wants servants who can become sons. He is full and flows over. He wants a world full of beings united to him, but still distinct. And that is where the troughs come in. You might wonder why God does not make more use of his power to be sensibly present to human beings in any degree he chooses and at any moment. But the irresistible and the indisputable are the two weapons which the very nature of his desire forbids him to use. Merely to override a human will as his felt presence in any but the faintest and most mitigated degree would most certainly do, would be for him useless. He wants the living beings to be one with him, but yet themselves. Merely to cancel them or assimilate them will not serve. He is prepared to do a little overriding at the beginning. He will set them off with communications of his presence, which, though faint, seem great to them, with emotional sweetness and easy conquest over temptation. But he never allows the state of affairs to last long. Sooner or later he withdraws, if not in fact, at least from their conscious experience, all those supports and incentives. He leaves the entity to stand up on its own legs, to carry out from the will alone duties which have lost all relish. It is during such trial periods, much more than during the peak periods, that it is growing into the sort of being he wants it to be. Hence, the prayers offered in the state of dryness are those which please him best. He wants the living being to learn to walk and must therefore take away his hand. And if only the will to walk is really there, he is pleased even with their stumbles. Illusion is never more in danger than when a human being, no longer desiring, but still intending to do the will of God, looks round upon a universe from which every trace of him seems to have vanished, and asks why he has been forsaken and still obeys. You have, if you go back to your worksheet, and if you turn the page, you will see that this is a self-evaluation form. I hope all of you have something to write with, a pen or a pencil or something. You don't have to prick your finger to write with your finger. And I'd like you to take about 10 minutes and do a self-evaluation here of those six areas. Whenever you're looking at some part of your sadhana that you'd like to improve. You take some, you make some vow, some determination, and first you make it for 3 days. We can do almost anything for 3 days, right? And then at the end, you evaluate. You decide, did you like it? Do you want to keep it? Want to forget it? Sometimes we take a vow to do something, we do it, I don't like it. Doesn't work for me. Do I want to keep it but modify it? Okay? And then, if we want to get rid of it altogether, then we try something else for 3 days. Until we find something that we either want to keep or keep, but maybe modify it. And then you say, okay, now I'm going to do it. Once you're satisfied for 3 days, once you've got 3 days that you're happy, you say, I like this. It's really added to the quality of my life. It's really added to the quality of my sadhana. Then you take a vow for 2 weeks. Same thing, at the end of the 2 weeks, evaluate it. Did I like it? Did I do it? Did I actually do it? Did I like it? Did I want to keep it? Did I want to forget it? Was it just a good experience for 2 weeks and that's it? Did I want to keep it and modify it? If you don't want to keep it, then you go back to the 3 days. Once you found something you want to keep for 2 weeks, then 1 month. Write it down. In each of these cases, write it down. For the next month, I will. I mean, this can be something simple, like I'm going to read a verse of Bhagavad Gita before each meal. I'm going to listen to a lecture when I drive to work. I'm going to go to bed by 9 o'clock. I'm going to spend at least 10 minutes reading Shastra with my children. Any of these things. You understand? Everybody got this? I'm not going to look at social media until after I finish my rounds. Or I'm going to set a timer for my time on social media and news for 15 minutes. Something like that. So it could be getting rid of something negative. It could be doing something positive. I'm only going to watch entertainment that inspires me in my Krishna consciousness. I'm only going to have 3 hours of entertainment a week. Something. Whatever. Whatever's your thing. Okay? Each of us are dealing with different things. Yes? Yes? Right? Maybe for some of us it's going to be I'm going to chant one round a day. Whatever it is for you. Maybe it's going to be I'm only going to eat home-cooked food. I'm going to listen to Prabhupada's lectures while I take a shower. Okay? Something that, whatever works for you, be creative. Something that you're going to do and something you're going to like. Right? Then after 1 month, again, you evaluate it. If you like it, you want to keep it, then do for 3 months. Okay, this is a little adaptation. Bhaktivinoda was a little different, but it's a similar concept. And you may find certain things just become a part of your life. I've done this with a number of things, and when I go back and look in my diary and I see what I wrote, some of these things I think, oh, I liked it so much that it just became a part of my life, and I don't even think about that I have to plan for it anymore. And some of the things I tried and went, it doesn't work for me. You try it and you make some adjustment. Right? So thank you very much. It is now 12:05. So we're going to take a break a little longer. So any of you chant Gayatri, you have enough time for that. Maybe we'll get together at 12:30. Okay? But I do want to start at 12:30 sharp. So does that mean in Mauritius I have to tell you 12:20? Yes. Okay, so come back in 2 minutes. That's better. Just have enough time to stand up and breathe. But no, I'm going to start at 12:30, Krishna willing, whether anybody's here or not. So if you're not here at 12:30, I'm just going to start without you. Is that all right? Krishna willing. Hare Krishna. Shri Prabhupada ki jai.